chapter 42. Then he brought me to the outer court, the way toward the north, to a chamber that was over against a separate place. So now he's describing a building on the north side. So now I think I need to try to show you what that looked like. All right, verse 2, even to the front of the length of 100 cubits, with the door on the north, and the breadth 50 cubits, over against or opposite the 20 cubits, which belongs to the inner court. This is describing now exactly how it's located. And he mentions gallery against gallery in 3 stories. And before the chambers were a walk of 10 cubits, breadth inward, and a way of 1 cubit, and the doors were towards the north. Now, the upper chambers were shorter. When we were looking at the temple building itself, remember those side rooms were larger as you went up higher. You know, they started out narrow, and then the next, I think they were, 4 cubits, 5 cubits, 6 or 7, or 4, 5, 6, I don't remember for sure. And so it is here, the exact opposite. It starts out with a broad base, and then it's a little narrower here, with, what does it call it here now? 10 cubits. And before the chambers was a walk of 10 cubits.
Here's your walk of 10 cubits. There, and there, and also there.
And then also a way of 2 cubits, apparently having reference to the doors being inset. Then he describes more things that I think we can skip over. Verse 13, then said he unto me, the north chambers and the south chambers. In other words, there are chambers on the north side of the temple, and identically to this are chambers on the south side, only oriented in the other direction. They are the holy chambers where the priests that are near unto the eternal shall eat the most holy things. In other words, it's a dining chamber for the priests, where they eat certain parts of the sacrifices, certain appropriate parts. And then it tells how that they, when they come in to serve, that they have to take off their, street clothes and put on their priestly garments. Verse 15, now when he had made an end of measuring the inner house, in other words, buildings in the inner area, he brought me forth by way of the gate whose prospect is towards the east and measured it round about. All right, so now he goes out of all of these inner buildings. He goes outside, out of the wall. In other words, he's going out now where he entered. Verse 16, and he measured the east side with a measuring reed, 500 reeds. Now, this is 3,000 feet. 3,000 cubits, or about 6,000 feet. In other words, he's talking about an area here that's more than a mile square. So in addition to the temple complex itself, there is an additional area of about a square mile that is devoted here for holy purposes. And then it had a wall and so forth. In verse 20, he measured it by the 4 sides. It had a wall round about the length 500, the breadth 500, to make a separation between that which is was holy and that which was common. All right, now I think that I will try to put all of this together and show you next the floor plan of this whole area. I'm not talking about the 3,000 cubits or over a mile square. I'm not talking about that, but the things that mostly we've been talking about. All right, now remember, according to Ezekiel's account, you enter through the east gate. He went in here, and then... Wait a minute, I'm sorry. Here's the east gate over here. He entered into the east gate, then he went to the north gate, and then he went to the south gate, then he went to the inner gate to the north. This is the inner gate to the north, this is the inner gate to the east, inner gate to the south. And then this is the temple building itself. I think I'll just step up here if I can... Alright, remember, as you come in this particular gate, there were places there to slay the sacrifices. and to skin them, to wash them, and so on. That took place in here. Then we read about the temple building itself. That's right here. Then there was another building that was to the rear. That's this building right here. Then we read about this building here, which is the dining chamber for the priest. Another one exactly like it, oriented in the opposite direction down here. Then there were other buildings here and here, which, and also some of these others that are rather faint and hard to determine exactly what they are. I have some of them labeled here. And we also read about 30 chambers that were on the pavement. Now, those are these rooms around here on three sides. See, you can't have it back on this side because you have this building back here. And then we haven't come to this yet, but in each corner is a place for cooking. And we'll see about that a little bit later and elaborate about that. Now, before we get back to the text, do you have questions about any of this? Yes.
What did the Jews come to? Why they gave him the east gate? Why he gave the east gate? Why the north gate? The south gate?
Well, I don't know why he did it that way. He's just describing it. He had to start somewhere.
Because the whole of the scattering would come from the east.
What scattering would come from the east?
The taking the captivity to the east.
Well, I didn't know that the captivity went to the east. So if I missed something, well, maybe you can tell me about it privately. I don't know of any significance to this as to why he starts here. But later on, we'll find out that that gate is closed to everyone except to God or to Christ. No one else can come through that gate after this. After Christ comes in and comes through that gate. From then on, if someone comes into the north gate, they have to go out the south gate. If they come in the south gate, they have to go out the north gate. And of course, all of this area here is just for priests only. The common person cannot come in there. This is the altar of the sacrifice here. Any other questions?
Yeah. You have a copy there?
Oh, I have several copies, but they're not available. Anything else? Yeah.
He said those little rooms there.
The what?
Cooking rooms at the corner, the cooking areas.
Yeah.
Like, they're a long way from dining
area. Well, I think you find out they're pretty close. You know, there's sometimes more than one dining room. Anything else? Yeah.
He said there was one temple you were talking about, one part of it, and they had the same dimensions as Solomon, except one of them.
Well, you can't see that in this particular one, but it's the porch. And the porch in Solomon's temple, the one dimension was 10 cubits. In this, it's 11 cubits. Well, it's the front part of this right here, which I showed you earlier. Another picture, yeah. 120 cubits. 240 feet. Well, let me go back. When David gave Solomon instructions to build the temple, he told him that here is the pattern that God had revealed to him. So God revealed to him a particular pattern, a particular style, particular dimensions, and all of that. And then he conveyed that to Solomon. Now, it would seem from certain scriptures that the temple was patterned after God's temple in heaven. And therefore, if it's patterned after God's temple in heaven, they would all have the same general pattern. They'd have the same general appearance. And therefore, when you read about Solomon's temple, or you read about, as it's later called, the second temple, or the third temple, and not so much the third temple or Herod's temple, because there they, I think, strayed away from the original pattern. And even, for that matter, the second temple, the pattern was not exactly the same. But anyway, the ones where God was involved, the pattern should be the same. And so I would expect that what you see described in Kings and Chronicles, telling about Solomon's temple, since it was patterned after God's temple in heaven, and God had given David the design and the appearance and the pattern and so forth, that this would be the same. And in Ezekiel, you read about the horizontal dimensions, but you don't read anything about vertical. So what are you going to do? Just have a floor plan? No, I think that the Chronicles and Kings tells you the vertical dimensions. And it gives you those essentials so you can put it all together. You know, God doesn't change. His mind is the same. Maybe he might alter things slightly, but in this case, apparently it's all the same except for that one dimension where the Bible specifically says, you know, in one case it's 10 and in the other case for the other temple it's 11. So, you don't find the vertical dimensions generally in Ezekiel, so you have to look at those other places to find those. And so therefore I say that what was in Solomon's time is what it's going to be again as far as the vertical dimensions, 120 cubits. 10 times 12, you know, there are 120 on the day of Pentecost. You know, 120 is the number that is used sometimes, 10 times 12. So forth. Anyway, that's where I get the vertical dimensions from Chronicles. It's only mentioned once in the Bible in Chronicles. Okay, maybe we should now continue on. And I might turn this on sometime if we have need. Chapter 43. Afterward, he brought me to the gate, even the gate that looks towards the east. That's where he had originally entered. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel came from the way of the east. So this is Christ as we know him, Yahweh as ancient Israel knew him, coming from the east, and his voice was like the sound of many waters, and the earth did shine with his glory. And the appearance of the vision which I saw was like the vision I saw when I came to destroy the city. And this takes you back now to the earlier chapters of Ezekiel. And the visions were like the vision that I saw by the river Kebar. And I fell upon my face, and the glory of the Lord came into the house by the way of the gate, whose prospect, or face, is toward the east. The Spirit took me up and brought me into the inner court, and behold, the glory of the Eternal filled the house. And I heard one speaking unto me out of the house, and a man stood by me. And he said unto me, Son of man, this is the place of my throne, and the place of the soles of my feet, where I will dwell in the midst of the children of Israel forever. And the house of Israel shall no more defile my holy name. Verse 10. Thou, son of man, show the house to the house of Israel, that they may be ashamed of their iniquities, and let them measure accurately. And if they be ashamed of all that they have done, make known unto them the form of the house, or we might say the style, the architectural style, I guess, and the fashion thereof, and the goings out thereof, and the coming in thereof, and all the forms thereof, and all the ordinances. And we haven't come now to the ordinances that relate to this. And all the laws thereof, and write it in their sight, that they may keep the whole form thereof, and all the ordinances thereof, and do them. This is the law of the house, upon the top of the mountain. You see, so it's on the top of the mountain where this is located. The whole limit thereof, round about, shall be most holy. Behold, this is the law of the house. Then he goes to describe the altar of sacrifice, and he again makes reference to this cubit being a cubit and a hand breadth, so it's longer than the normal cubit that was known at that particular time. Then, starting at verse 18, he tells about the sons of Zadok, and the ordinances relating to the altar that they are supposed to institute when this is constructed. And this describes how that particular altar can be consecrated or purified, maybe consecrated is a better word. And this, of course, takes a period of 7 days. Now, do we have any comments or questions over this chapter, which I've gone over rather quickly? Yes. There will be sacrifices, and so if there will be, I guess you have to have places for them. Oh, yes. This is one place that mentions that. And there are several other places that do as well. I would say this, that in the past people have sacrificed looking forward to the sacrifice of Christ. I would presume if you can look forward to the sacrifice, you can also look backward towards it. And to maybe emphasize to those people the sacrifice that Christ gave for them, to remind them of it. There may be other purposes, and that's a totally different subject by itself that, requires a little preparation and thought that I haven't prepared for. Yes. They reconciled them to the community. They settled the score, you might say. They paid the penalty as far as the community is concerned, and then they were to remind them of Christ or to teach them obedience. And maybe some of these people need to be taught obedience as well. Okay, well, that's quite a, different than a deep subject by itself, and I don't have all the answers right now. There will be sacrifices, the wise, a little bit more of a question. Of course, right now you can't have sacrifices, there is no temple. And they did have sacrifices as long as there was a temple, as long as there were animals. And then when they couldn't get any more animals, then the sacrifices ceased, which was about, in 70 A.D., which was almost 40 years after Christ was crucified, sacrifices continued. Now, some people think, that he was killed in 31 A.D., and the veil of the temple was torn in two, and then they stopped having any sacrifices. That's not true. It went on for another almost 40 years. Did you have a question? I would doubt that, but I don't know. I don't know why he comes to the east gate, except that's a straight way into the temple. The other ways, you have to make a turn to get there. I don't know. I couldn't say. Why God does something, I don't know. I'm sorry, I don't. Why he does it the way he does it. Yeah. It's apparently on Mount Zion, which is the east side of Jerusalem, as we think of Jerusalem. If you're talking about the ancient city of Jerusalem, it would be the southeast hill. If you're talking about modern Jerusalem, surrounds this area. If you're talking about the Jewish part of Jerusalem, it's mainly way off to the west from here. But it is surrounded, you might say, by Jerusalem. The metropolitan area of Jerusalem surrounds this. Anything else? Okay, let's then continue on. We were talking about the consecration of the altar. And now we come to chapter 44. And he brought me back the way of the outer gate of the sanctuary, which looks toward the east, and it was shut. And the Eternal said unto me, this gate shall be shut. Remember, this is the one that he entered into to start with. This gate shall be shut, it shall not be opened, neither shall any man enter in by it, for the Eternal God of Israel has entered in by it, therefore it shall be shut. As for the prince, being a prince, he shall sit therein to eat bread before the Eternal. He shall enter by the way of the porch of the gate, and shall go out by the way of the saints. So even the prince is not able to enter in at this particular gate. He can come into the north gate or the south gate, but not in the east gate. And you might say, well, who is the prince? And only one I could give as a possibility would be David, who is called the prince. Then he begins to describe here the ordinances or laws concerning the priesthood at that particular time. So now we have quite a number of miscellaneous laws relating to them. Also about who would be able to enter and who would not be able to. In verse 9 it says that no alien uncircumcised in heart, in other words, no stranger or foreigner or Gentile who is unconverted and uncircumcised in flesh shall enter into my sanctuary. So before anyone can go in there, they have to be circumcised in two ways, spiritually and physically. Then, starting in verse 15, he mentions again about the sons of Zadok, that kept the charge of my sanctuary when the children of Israel went astray from me. They shall come near me to minister and stand before me, and so on and so forth. Then it tells more details of what they can or cannot do. And then in chapter 45, he says that you shall divide the land for inheritance. So now he not only describes the temple, but he describes various land divisions. And here now he's talking about a large area devoted for specific purposes, which I'm not going to go into in any detail. Let's see, it seems to me in, is it one of the handbooks, Halley's handbook, or Unger's handbook, it gives you sort of a drawing of this. It seems to me that's where I've seen this. There's an area for the Levites or the priests. Then there's also an area for the prince. Then starting in about verse 10, about just balances. Verse 13, about certain offerings. Verse 18, the offerings for some of the holy days. Then in chapter 46, the new moon and the Sabbath, and certain things relating to that. Let's pick it up here in verse 9. But when the people of the land shall come before the Eternal in the appointed seasons, he that enters by the way of the north gate to worship shall go forth by the way of the south gate. And he that enters by way of the south gate shall go forth by the way of the north gate. He shall not return by the way of the gate whereby he came in, but shall go straight before him. All right, now let's skip on a little bit further. Chapter 46, verse 11. Some of the feasts and sacrifices. Now let's come to verse 19, and I'd like to read a little section here. And he brought me through the entry, which was at the side of the gate, into the holy chambers for the priest which looks towards the north. And behold, there was a place on the hinder part westward. And he said, this is the place where the priests shall boil the guilt offering and the sin offering, where they shall bake the meal offering, and they shall bring them not forth into the outer court to sanctify the people. Now, I would take it that he's talking here about this area here, marquee. Then verse 24, and he brought me forth into the outer court and caused me to pass by the four corners of the court. So now he's talking about these four corners here, Mark 2. And behold, in every corner of the court there was a court. So this is a court within a court. In the four corners of the court there were courts enclosed, 40 cubits long and 30 broad. These four in the corners were of one measure. In other words, they were all identical. And there was a row of masonry round about in them, round about the four, and it was made with boiling places under the rows round about. Then he said unto me, these are the boiling places where the ministers of the house, or the Levites, shall boil the sacrifices of the people. Now, why would they boil the sacrifices of the people? They boil and bake the part that the priest used, and I've mentioned that the and probably D as well, but it's not so clear about B, but at least D, the buildings marked D, are the dining rooms for the priests. So you have a place to cook and a place to eat for the priests, and now you have a place to cook for the people, but where are they going to eat? Anybody have any ideas? In the 30 chambers. Now, it doesn't say that, but it seems logical to me that that is what all of those 30 chambers are. There are 30 dining rooms for the people. And they're right close at hand. Somebody made some comment about that, about it being some distance away. Because, you see, when a person brings an animal for sacrifice, at least certain types of offerings, they keep a certain part, the priest keeps a certain part, and part of it is burned on the altar. And this would be the place, you see, for the people to have theirs cooked, and so they could eat it there. Now, all of this seems so strange to all of us, I know. You know, we don't have animal sacrifices now, and that seems, I think, to some of us, barbaric. Does it seem that way to you? Something that God instituted, that God commanded, and you think is barbaric. You think, you know, that's ancient history. That is terrible if God would do that. Now, you go up to this place, and there's something over there on the altar burning. And what does it smell like? Does it smell like a sweet savor, or does it smell like somebody burned at something? We think of it as burning, you know, and burning food maybe not so enjoyable. But is there any of you here who don't like to smell the smell of steak cooking? So you go in there and you smell this aroma, and also, I suppose, of the four cooking areas as well. You smell that cooking as well as what's cooking over there on the altar. And you come in there and you see the glory of the God of Israel. Undoubtedly, you're given a spiritual lesson or instruction or whatever in the process. But you go there and you dine, you know, in God's presence. You go and eat there in God's presence. Now, what's so barbaric about all that? You know, I think some people of us, you know, we have the idea, well, this is strange, and we can't understand, well, why are we going to have to do this all over again? Or why are the people going to have to do that? Well, they're going to learn, I think, a lot of lessons from this. They're going to see things, they're going to hear things, they're going to smell things, they're going to touch things. You know, all of the senses are going to be exercised, including, you know, the spiritual aspect, by going up here to Jerusalem. You know, this will, people will be coming from all over the world to do this. Now, that's a different subject that the book of Ezekiel here does not relate to. Whatever you read about here, at least almost everything you read about, relates to physical. So it's talking about sacrifice, it's talking about a physical building, and for that matter, where are the spirit beings going to be there? How much space does it take for a spirit being? What do they have to have? What kind of an office do they have to have? This is talking about a physical priesthood. It's talking about a physical building, a physical ritual, and so on. This is not addressing the spiritual aspect. As far as I know, it would be David. I don't know of any other name to suggest. Well, I presume they're for the priests. Now, if you think one of them is there for you, you know, there are only 90 of them. Well, the dining room is where they eat. And then there's also a room there for changing into the priestly vestments and so on. But there are specific purposes for all of those buildings that in most cases is mentioned. But as far as those little side chambers, there's no references to how they are used or what they're used for. Now, the Bible says in my Father's house are many rooms. And this is God's house. There are a lot of rooms there. And we say, well, that represents positions in God's kingdom. And it does. But I think sometimes we think, well, now I'm going to have a position in God's kingdom, I'm going to have one of those rooms somewhere. But this is providing for physical things as far as I can see, and not talking about the spiritual offices of God's kingdom. I guess some people have argued, you know, how many angels can sit on the head of a pin? You know, that do spiritual things take up space? I don't know, I've never seen a spirit being. I don't know how big they are. Maybe they might look pretty big or pretty small. I don't know. I don't think they look small, but you know, I don't know what spiritual arrangements God is making for His government. That's not addressed here in my understanding of this. Well, in Revelation 21, there is no temple. I read it. It says there is no temple therein because the Father and Christ, you know, are the temple. Now, there's a city mentioned, but this isn't a city. No, there isn't going to be any temple there. Read it. Read the book. Pardon? I would believe it would be during the millennium and the white throne judgment period. Yes, this will be destroyed along with the whole earth. You know, it's going to be destroyed. It's going to melt like with fervent heat. And then there's going to be a new heaven and a new earth. And then the new Jerusalem comes down.
Yes.
Well, now you're going maybe a little further than I would say. I won't comment very much about that because, you know, what God is going to require, if he's going to require everybody to have an offering every time they sin, we'll need a million temples like this. Well, if you have, say, for example, what do we have in the earth today? 3 billion people? 4 billion people? Now, you take 4 billion people, and 4 billion people going up there year by year, making sacrifices. I don't think that that's what's going to happen. I don't know. I don't think it's... Pardon? No, but before the 1,000 years is over, and then after that, the 100-year period, or however long it is, the White Throne Judgment, there will be probably that many or more. I would think at the end of the millennium and also during that White Throne Judgment, there would be multiple billions, probably a lot more than we have today. I would think maybe that various families or cities or whatever maybe might have representatives to do some of these things. It would be more of a symbolic thing than going back under the Levitical ritual as you find in the book of Leviticus and other places. Yeah, I hope you don't get the idea from all of this we're going back under the Levitical ritual. But there will be sacrifices. And what will be required as far as the people are concerned, I don't know. It's surely not talking about everybody going back to that ritual system. It'd rather be a sort of a symbolic thing. I would sort of compare it to, say, what we do down in Washington, D.C. There's a lot of pomp and ceremony and so on that goes on over there in the name of the people of the United States. And from time to time, people go down there to Washington, D.C. and see what's going on in the Congress or in the White House or some special occasion and so on and so forth, then maybe that's a poor comparison, but I don't know what else to say. That's the capital of the United States. This is going to be the capital of the world. And there will be certain ceremonies that will take place there that the whole world will look to and will be aware of. And from time to time will take part in whatever way God would specify. But you can see that there is a physical limitation on the number of sacrifices that can be handled in such a small area, and also in the number of people that can go there. Oh, yeah, it names them here. Then you can go back. It's not exactly the same, I don't think, in every respect as back in the Levitical time. Yes, the book of Leviticus. Oh, it mentions, I've already read several places where it mentions them. My eye just falls here on verse 12 of chapter 46. And when the prince shall prepare a free will offering, a burnt offering, or a peace offering, as a free will offering unto the Eternal, one shall open for him the gate, and so on. Then in verse 13, it shall prepare a lamb. Pardon? Well, I think in this case it's talking about David, but in some of the other cases it mentions the specific offerings. No, I wouldn't think so. But he is the prince, you see, which he is the ruler over Israel. It might be speaking of a successor, a physical prince. All right, now let's see if we can go ahead, otherwise I'm afraid we're not going to finish. Now, chapter 47, we find described here now a river that comes out from under the threshold of the temple, going towards the east, and it flows just south of the altar, and it goes out somewhere through the gate or through the maybe under the wall, I just don't know, and it just trickled forth out from under there apparently. And then he describes, he goes out 1,000 cubits along this creek or river, whatever you might want to call it, depending on where you're looking at it, I guess. But he goes out 1,000 cubits, or about 2,000 feet, which is what? About a third of a mile, several blocks. And he walked across it, and the water only came up to his ankles. Then he went out another 1,000 cubits, another distance, about the same. And now the water was up to his knees. Then he goes out a third thousand. So now this is, we'll see, a thousand times three, that's 3,000. That's 6,000 feet. That's over a mile now. And the waters were up to his loins. And then he goes out a fourth thousand. So this is now another, 8,000 feet total, approximately. And it was a river that he couldn't pass through. There were waters to swim in. You'd have to swim to go across it. Then he describes how that this goes on to the east and shall go down to the Araba. Now, the Araba is that low valley that runs more or less north and south through the land of Palestine, from up by the Sea of Galilee down to the Jordan River, through the Dead Sea, and then off down to the Gulf of Aqaba. It's a very, what will you say, a rather level, flat valley with steep sides. And apparently at one time way back in the far past, there was a huge rift, a huge earthquake or whatever, and that particular section of land just dropped, 2,000 feet or so, I don't know exactly, from what it had been before. And so they call that the Great Rift Valley. It even continues down into the Red Sea, on into Africa. But now the water, you see, goes down into that valley and shall enter into the sea, and is talking here specifically of the Dead Sea, into the sea of the putrid waters, the waters shall be healed. And so now the Dead Sea isn't going to be dead any longer. As it is today, I guess nothing lives there because it's so salty. And it shall come to pass that every living creature wherewith it swarms shall come to life, and so on. There'll be a great multitude of fish, and that all things be healed and may live whithersoever the river comes. And then he describes how that they're going to stand by fishing from Engedi, even on Enneglium. There's going to be a place for spreading of nets, where, of course, now, you know, that's just a desert with this salt sea where nothing lives. Then it says they're going to have as many fish as they have in the Great Sea or the Mediterranean Sea. But there are still going to be some miry places and marshes and so forth where people can get salt. And there'll be all kinds of trees along the side of this particular river. And there'll be new fruit every month. And then, starting in verse 13, we find now the boundaries for the 12 tribes of Israel. And he describes them, saying Joseph is going to have two portions, and then he describes a boundary, which I won't go into, and then let's come to chapter 48. Well, let's notice one thing here in verse 23. And it shall come to pass that in what tribe the stranger sojourns, there shall you give him his inheritance, says the Eternal God. In other words, if there are people of different races that are with Israel at that particular time, they can become what? I guess we would call them naturalized citizens today. And so then they become a part of that tribe, so that others of who strangers or sojourners then can become a part of Israel. Now he describes the names of the tribes and the order, starting from the north with Dan. And then in the center section, I'm skipping over quite a bit of it, there's a section for Judah, and also another section here set apart for a holy purpose. And it gives the dimensions of that, which I think you can see commonly in various commentaries, or even some, I think, of the, what do you call them, the... The word doesn't come to me, not geographies, but they have some of these, not Bible dictionary. Well, the name won't come to me. Atlas. Even some Bible atlases will show this. I think the one of them that I have does show this area. All right, let's come down to about verse 30. And these are the goings out of the city. On the north side, 4,500 reeds by measure, and the gates of the city shall be after the names of the tribes of Israel. There are going to be three gates on the north and three on each of the other sides, one for each of the tribes. And verse 35, it shall be 18,000 reeds round about, and the name of the city from that day shall be the Eternal is here, or is there rather, Yahweh is here, or in other words, Jesus Christ. This is where he is. This is where he's going to stay, as we already have read, forever, or throughout this whole period of time, the millennium, the great white throne judgment. And of course, after that comes the new heavens and the new earth, and again, he will be right in the same geographical area, but a new, renewed earth. So, that's it rather quickly. Now, do we have any questions, or would you like to see any of these drawings over again after we've gone through it? Yes?
This last chapter we just went through, it talks about man being in a park, in a portion of the land, and heaven being. But they're not mentioning that. 12,000, 144,000.
Well, that's a totally different thing, of course, which occurs before this period. Pardon? Yes. That has to do with the time immediately prior to and at the return of Jesus Christ. This is sometime later. I don't know how much later, but the kind of temple you find described here is going to take quite a while to build, I'm sure. I presume they won't even start building this for several years after Christ returns. Maybe a long while. I have no idea how long. And then after they start to build it, it's probably going to take quite a while. It took Solomon, what was it, 7 years? I think it was 7 years, to build just the temple itself without all of these other buildings. Other questions? Other comments? Yes.
This spiritual temple, when you went through it, can you compare it with the New Jerusalem and Revelations at all?
No, there's no connection between these. The New Jerusalem, you know, it's 1,500 miles square, roughly. We're talking about a temple here that's a few hundred feet square.
What about the rivers? The river that flows out of the New Jerusalem?
Yes, well, it's not the same one. Different river, different age. This river is going to be burned to a crisp and then end. It's going to be vaporized before that one even is even comes. Yes. Well, now, these are not just the outer gates. These are all the gates. Well, I see. I forgot we have one more picture also that I'll show you. Well, I have several more here. I guess I better spend the time showing them. Now, this is what I thought that the pillars looked like. Very ornate. You've probably forgotten about it, but even Jeremiah said a little bit about these pillars, described them somewhat. They're huge. Let's see, I've forgotten the size now. It seems they're about 35 feet high, something like that, yes.
Is that cloth of metal?
No, it's a checker work made of metal, made of brass or bronze. Sort of a lace, metal lace. And then there are pomegranates there, and various other things. Okay, that should be enough for that. The doors. This one here would be the main door. You know that there are two doors and two leaves each. This would be the knob down here. Give you sort of an idea of how high the thing is. And then the other one, let's see, is one, two, three. This door is five-sided. And that's the only way I could make five sides out of it. And this shows you the top view of how they would fold.
I'll leave the best to last.
That's the whole thing. That took Mr. Snook many an hour. Yes. Well, it says it comes out from under the threshold over here. Oops. The threshold would be over here. And it comes out and goes out to the outside there somewhere. Anything else? Looks like we're just about ready to close.
The east gate is to be closed after Christ ended.
Right, right.
That is both east gate.
No, just the outer, just the outer one.
Just the outer.
Yes.
How could you give us an idea of when the water does come out, say it goes down the Dead Sea?
Yes.
Just as it described it, I had a hard time following it. As it goes out, it gives the direction of the territory it went across to the Dead Sea.
Well, I think if you will get a map, a topographical map, you'll see that there, the way it presently is, it would have to head down towards Jericho. However, there's another factor that comes into play, and that is another scripture in Zechariah mentions how the Mount of Olives, which is directly to the east here, is going to split in two. And one part's going to move to the north, one other part's going to move to the south. So it would be possible that the stream or the river would go out that direction. And then it mentions some places like Eneglium, or however it's pronounced, and you can look on the map and see where that is. You know, it's along the western shore of the Dead Sea, I believe. Yes. Well, this is, I didn't elaborate very much on that. There are quite a few other descriptions there that I have not studied carefully, but there are some drawings that you'll find that show these various allotments for the various tribes and also the various holy enclaves, I guess you might call them, for various specific holy purposes. And that's just describing one of those, I believe. No, it's I think it's describing things, first of all, in cubits, secondly, in reeds. And a reed, you see, is 6 cubits, or about 12 feet. And usually I think it has it in that measure, those long measures. Anything else? We're about ready to end for now. Looks like that's it for tonight. Hope that you understand a little bit more now about Ezekiel.